Good day, Scarswellians and people everywhere. It's If again. It's a rare privilege not to have to think too much about what happens when you flush the toilet. The sewer system beneath Scarswell, I'm told, goes back to the Victorian age. And while few of the denizens of Scarswell might imagine it, there's a whole other world beneath our feet. We were a long walk from the surface when Trevor's headlamp went out. I saw him ahead of me, wading through the muck, looking down to watch every step. You don't want to tread on a rat if you can help it, but having everything slop over the top of your boot is almost as bad. "I'll take the right turn," Trevor said. "You take the left." And adjusting his gloves, he turned and disappeared at the intersection. I've always thought that if you get lost in the sewers without a light, you've got the better part of an hour before you lose your mind. At first, you'll carefully, methodically feel your way along the walls, convinced that you can work this out if you stay calm. But unless you get lucky, you'll be tearing your fingertips to the quick, scrabbling madly for an exit before you know it. I might have been optimistic. I was splashing along in my own little halo of light when the screaming started. "Trevor," I called into the murk. "Trevor, what the hell's going on?" It was no use. He was already lost to the tunnel. In my mind, I heard his footsteps getting weaker, saw him taking a series of wrong turns before he was lost for good. "Trevor," I said again, trying to keep my voice nice and steady. "Trevor, stay where you are, all right? I'll catch up to you." It might have been useless. You lose your sense of direction so quickly in the tunnels, and from the sound of the yelps and the sobs that were bouncing all around the walls, I got the sense that he was going the wrong way. Already disoriented, probably he spun around on the spot a few times when his lamp went out. He had chosen wrong, and he was bearing down on a short life lived underground. I sped up. He hadn't been far ahead when he turned off the main channel, but I couldn't move very fast now that the slop was up to my calves. I felt it crest my boot. Told myself a future was coming, a happy future in which I could have a shower and burn my socks. I was still calling Trevor's name, but it was no use. I reached the junction and turned into it, my headlamp illuminating the gloom for yards in front of my face. The tunnel disappeared, though, into soggy blackness, and Trevor was nowhere to be seen. With every step I took, I thought of the dwindling battery of my own headlamp, and I reached for the flashlight at my waist, touching it like a religious person seeking comfort in an icon. I labored on, hoping Trevor wasn't too far gone, already believing that he might be. I didn't have to worry about giving up hope. I only took a few steps when I heard splashing, far off in the tunnel ahead of me, growing steadily faster and louder as a long, breathless wail started to ripple the surface of the water underfoot. He started as a speck, and then Trevor, clad in his orange protective gear, emerged, tearing toward me. I thought he might be glad to see me, but the look in his eyes was wild. Rather than meeting him with open arms, I had to dive out of the way. If I hadn't, he would surely have knocked me to the ground and kept on running, into the darkness in some other direction. Trevor's boots clipped my own as I pressed myself against the hollow side of the tunnel. In a splay of limbs and a spray of foul water, he went on running but started to stagger, his momentum bringing him to his knees in a heap, just at the intersection where he had turned before. I got to Trevor, and his eyes were something else. I knew at once that he had seen some great horror in the tunnel. An anaconda? Someone's flushed pet fish grown to gargantuan size? I couldn't say, and Trevor was gibbering like he'd never make sense again. Standing over him, I reached down for his belt, found the handheld torch he'd had all along, and placed it in his hand. He looked up at me like he'd never imagined it was there, like it was some gift from heaven and I was the angel who had carried it to him. "Come on," I said, starting down the tunnel from whence we had come earlier in the day. "That's enough of this." With a fresh set of clothes and a strong cup of tea in front of him, Trevor finally looked like he was coming back to us. He took a long, slurping sip of tea, looking down and contemplating the scum sitting on top of it. "Trevor," I said. I wasn't sure how to raise the subject. Maybe I came over a little too jaunty. "What did you see down there?" He looked at me oddly, but then again, when you're used to working the sewers with somebody, they always look odd back on the surface. They're not wearing a hard hat for a start. Also, they're not constantly wrinkling their nose. "Didn't see nothing, did I?" he said. "My light went out." "I guess I meant it figuratively," I said. Trevor looked at me blankly. "I mean, what did you encounter? What did you experience? What did you find?" "Jesus," Trevor said. "I don't know, but it was massive." "Massive," I said slowly. "All right. Can you narrow it down a bit more?" Trevor sighed. "I was walking, right? Thought I was heading back for the main tunnel, but obviously I was wrong, wasn't I?" I nodded. Trevor was, obviously, wrong. "All of a sudden I couldn't walk anymore. It was like I was stuck on something. It was like some sort of monster." I raised my eyebrows. "Monster?" I tried hard to detect any sense that Trevor was joking, but I couldn't find any. Actually, there was desperation in his eyes now, and in the tone of his voice as he spoke. "I'm not kidding, I swear. Look, I know how it sounds. No, it sounds like I'm losing my marbles. Maybe I am, but I could feel it. Warm it was. And I could feel its skin. Stank, too." Well, no surprises there, I thought. We were in a sewer. I didn't say so, though. Trevor looked to be losing his faculties of reason. "Trevor," I said, "what exactly did it feel like?" "Huge," he said, which didn't really answer the question. "And rough and hard and, I don't know, slimy. Greasy. You know them stories of alligators in the sewer system under New York, eating rats and growing gigantic? I don't know, what if it was one of them or something like it? Grown so big it filled the tube and I could only feel its tail." Trevor might not have been much of a storyteller, but I didn't doubt the seriousness of what he was saying. He really believed he'd found something awful, even if an overgrown alligator slithering its way through the sewers beneath darkest Scarswell wasn't exactly plausible. In fact, I felt like I had a more likely solution. "Trevor," I said. "Trevor, Trevor, Trevor. You know what I think?" "What?" "I think you might have run into a fatberg." Trevor gawped at me. Any self-respecting sewer jockey ought to have known what I meant, but he wasn't exactly the slickest turd in the tunnel. "People pour their cooking oil down the sink, you see," I began, "and bacon fat and grease and all the rest of it. And they flush stuff down that they ought not to be flushing down." "Baby wipes," Trevor said, and then looked sheepish at his own knowledge. "Saw this on telly," he added. "Right," I said. And so it all sticks together and it blocks off the tunnels. That big, though? I'm afraid so, I said. Some of the ones in London are as big as double-decker buses, you know. Blimey. I took a long, fortifying sip of my own tea. It felt good to have talked Trevor down from the precipice. Now we could get on to more practical matters. Anyway, I said, we're going to have to move it. Go down there with shovels. Maybe bring some extra batteries this time. Trevor shuddered like he wasn't fully convinced. We'll be all right, I said gently. You'll see. All in a day's work for lads like us. Nothing to worry about. Later that day, I told all of this to my wife and kids over the dinner table. Jenny used to object to this kind of thing. No sewer talk at the dinner table, she'd say. It's pretty tough to argue with that logic. But I suppose her attitude has softened over the years. That or she's just got resigned to my stories. Anyway, the kids eat them up. Two of them we've got, twin boys, and they get into the age where they live for anything gross or gruesome. Luckily, in my line of work, there's never much of a shortage of either, even though I keep some of the worst of it from them. Some of the things I've seen down there, not sure Jenny would cope with hearing about either, to be honest. If you don't stop playing with your food, I said, then you won't get to hear the story of Billy B. Fatberg, will you? The boys have been chucking peas at each other, little chubby palmfuls of peas thrown back and forth. You had to admire the economics of it. Neither boy ended up with more or less peas than he started with. But when they heard there was a story on the way, they started shoveling in a couple of forkfuls apiece, just to show that they meant business. Years and years ago in Scarswell, I said, there was a young man who never ate his dinner. I watched my sons look at each other, widen their eyes, and scoop up some mashed potatoes. This young man, I said, Billy, his name was, he ate so little that he started to waste away. He didn't eat his peas, didn't eat his mash, didn't eat his fish fingers either. So he just started getting smaller and smaller. Even Jenny was looking interested by now, listening with an indulgent smile. You don't marry and procreate with a sewer man unless you've got a pretty open mind. Of course, I went on, this was all happening pretty slowly. He didn't notice himself getting smaller at first, and nor did his mum and dad. Every day he got a little bit shorter and a little bit thinner. Maybe if they'd have noticed, he might have been rescued. But they didn't. And little Billy B. Fatberg himself didn't realise there was a problem either. Not until the day he was sitting on the toilet seat, minding his own business like any self-respecting young gentleman might, and he suddenly fell through the seat, slipped into the U-bend, and disappeared down into the sewers. You've got to hand it to my kids. 5-year-old boys in general, maybe. They were hanging on my every word by now, enthralled at this grisly tale of a boy called Billy B. Fatberg. But it sure wasn't going to put them off their food. They were shoveling the stuff into their mouths like they were getting ready to throw on their boots, shoulder their shovels, and do a double shift in Scarswell's watery downstairs. And I know what you're thinking, I said. You're wondering what happened to him next, if anybody ever found him. And the answer to that is that his parents looked all over the place for him. They looked all over the house first of all, they looked behind all the furniture, then they looked up and down the street. Then they looked all over Scarswell, but they never found him. Some people, though, say he's still there, down in the sewers. Of course, he disappeared many, many years ago now. He would be an old man. But there's miles and miles of tunnels down there to roam. Lots of slimy little holes to hide in. An old man might even get used to it, if he doesn't mind having a few rats for company. Around about now, Jenny shot me a warning look. The grown-up version of this story might have had some more colourful details about Billy's life down in the sewers. But bath time was approaching, and I saw my cue to wrap things up. Some say he's still hoping for a real friend, though, I said. But do you know why he's never had one? The boys looked at each other and then back at me. Why? They mouthed together. Because, I said, ever since the day Billy disappeared, all the little boys in Scarswell know to finish their dinner. I pointed at the two empty plates in front of them. The lads looked about ready to high-five each other, but they didn't get the chance. Their mother slipped between them and picked up their plates. Now come on, she said. That's enough stories for one night. 20 minutes of telly and then it's bath time. All right? I woke up from dreams of Billy B. Fatberg expecting a tough day ahead. But when I got to the surface station, I found Trevor at least was in pretty good spirits. Not the artificial, jabbering cheer of someone about to face something that terrifies them. He slurped his instant coffee with relish before we suited up. And by the time he slung his shovel over one shoulder, he was positively whistling with glee. "What's put you in such a good mood?" I said. Trevor looked up at me and shrugged. By now he was opening the central manhole and getting ready to lower down his tools. "What's not to like?" he said. "We're off to slay the monster." Something about Trevor's shift in disposition made me uneasy. I remembered watching him tell me about the monster in the tunnels just the day before, the way his teacup shook gently as he brought it to his mouth. Now he looked ready to head to the fun fair and try his luck on the steady hand game. I pictured Trevor with an enormous teddy bear on his back, and I couldn't help but smile. It didn't last long, though. We joined our tools at the bottom of the ladder and let our eyes adjust, our headlamps sweeping over the dripping bricks of the tunnel wall. A solitary rat got caught in the beam of mine and looked back at me with contempt. Some people are scared of rodents because they scurry around too fast on their little legs. Spend a bit of time in the sewers, though, and you'll realise it's scarier when they stay still. Just watching you. Trevor was whistling again, already squelching through the tunnel ahead of me. It was tuneless, his whistling, and it bounced around the tunnels like someone had thrown a ball off them. But a part of me, at least, was glad of it all the same. If the two of us got separated somehow, even if I ended up without my headlight, I could follow the sound of the whistling and get back to him. "How's the family?" I said. You never quite get used to making small talk in the smog and slurry of the tunnels, but sometimes you feel like trying all the same. "Don't know, do I?" Trevor said. "The wife kicked me out again." "I'm sorry," I said, because I was. "I didn't know," I said, because I didn't. Not that it wasn't a familiar story. Trevor alluded often enough to problems at home, and sometimes I wondered what demons he was keeping from me. It seemed strange to keep all the darkness inside you bottled up as you traipsed through the tunnels of deepest Scarswell, knee-deep in the town's most noxious offerings, and then let it all out when you got home. Maybe it was just that his wife could never get used to the smell. It was an acquired taste, so to speak. "Not a problem," Trevor said. "Nothing can spoil my mood today." Trevor reached an intersection before I did, and he swung around on the spot, throwing his headlamp's beam down the tunnels. I joined him and did the same, and I saw nothing but the oozing brickwork, the shaft of light disappearing ahead of me, swallowed up by the darkness like water rushing down a plug hole. "Next one," I said, "I think." Effluent oozed from the modest streams around and above us, joining us on the main thoroughfare. Scarswell may not have had a mass transit system, but at least it had this, an endless highway of tunnels beneath itself, carrying away whatever the city discarded, a digestive system all of its own. I tried not to think too much about what that made Trevor and me. It didn't take much longer to get there. This time I was sure of it. We'd arrived at the right-hand turn where Trevor's light had gone out. I had to remind myself that this was only a day before. What with the high drama, the debrief over tea and toast, and the dreams of Billy B. Fatberg that plagued me all through the night, felt like weeks had passed. But if any doubt had crept into my mind over these 24 hours, at least now I was reassured. We approached the blockage that had scared Trevor out of his wits, and as the shifting light of our headlamps was thrown over it, it was clear enough that I'd been right. It was fat, all right. A vast bolus of the stuff that damn near filled the tunnel. Greyish-white, like the unwashed columns of the town hall. Unlike the columns of the town hall, though, you could see all the bits of matter that flecked it. Baby wipes and prophylactics, paper towels and tampons. Even, as I drew closer still, what looked like half a man's shirt and several whole onions. "Christ," I said. "I tell you what, Trevor, it was a good job you found this thing. If it gets much bigger, some people are going to end up having some unfinished business with their toilets." Trevor didn't answer. He was gawping mirthlessly up at the thing. I allowed him a moment to take in its majesty. Eventually he turned to me, grinned broadly, and slung the shovel down from his shoulder. "Let's get cracking," he said. It was slow and stodgy work. Though they were the best thing for the job as far as I could imagine, our shovels still felt woefully inadequate as they carved through the fat, breaking it up into ever smaller globules. It was like carving a bar of soap apart with a teaspoon. I was starting to sweat beneath all my protective gear. Had I not been in a fog of the townspeople's finest work, I might have been tempted to take my shirt off. I distracted myself with thoughts of the normal life of Scarswell humming by above us. The rumbling of cars, the laughter, the clatter of shop doorways, the long, lingering groans. I stopped dead. I turned slowly to face Trevor, and I could see that he had heard what I heard. Not from above us, but from the tunnel, dead ahead. A horrible low moan that came, as sure as day, from the other side of the ever-thinning wall of fat in front of us. "What the hell was that?" Trevor said. "Gas escaping," I said. So quickly it must have been clear I hadn't even begun to convince myself. "Must be. Stuff shifting in the pipe. Come on, let's crack on." Trevor swung his shovel again at the grease wall, but he did so with more trepidation this time. The blade hit the fat with a dull thud. I couldn't help but do the same, growing more half-hearted in my movements the clearer it became that we didn't have much further to go. Trevor, bless his heart, was the first to breach the wall. High up, close to the roof of the tunnel, he knocked out a great chunk and I heard it splash to the ground on the other side. There was a rushing of air through the hole in our direction, a blast that was strangely warm and smelled even worse than everything else, sewage with an overpowering note of rot. There was no mistaking the sound this time, a long, low groan that thinned out to a rattle at its end. I turned to watch Trevor, saw doubt spread across his face. He looked longingly in the other direction, back the way we had come. "Come on," I said stupidly. "There's two of us." With a fresh new energy, I swung my spade into what was left of the fat berg with genuine anger. I wasn't interested in clearing the blockage anymore. I only wanted to smash it to pieces, to raise the shovel like an axe and have serious words with whatever was on the other side. One more almighty swing was all it took. The tunnel was virtually clear, the blockage in bits at my feet. Trevor and I both looked wildly around, throwing the light from our headlamps all over the walls, into the inky darkness we had just exposed. I reached for his arm. "Stop," I said. I looked into the tunnel. I saw nothing, nothing but a few ripples in the water. But with both our voices hushed, and our breathing forced and frantic, I swear I heard the splashing of footsteps, disappearing into the depths of the tunnel ahead.
Here at the Skarsgård Tourists Information Office, we rely on our listeners. If you enjoy our stories, please consider supporting us on Patreon and find our newsletter, merch, and more at skarsgårdonsea.com. We'll see you in 2 weeks. We're so very sorry.